KRWG News this week, I'm Fred Martino. We continue our coverage of the insurrection at the U.S. Capitol and the political unrest throughout the country. Coming up, an in-depth conversation with New Mexico U.S. Senator Martin Heinrich. But first, President Donald Trump this week became the first president to be impeached twice. Despite all that's happened over the last 4 years, Trump won the hearts of voters across the rural West. But how are they feeling after last week's insurrection? In depth, here's Nate Hedgie of the Mountain West News Bureau.
Last summer, I met with Ben Bardo outside the small town of Du Bois, Wyoming. He's a huge Trump supporter, and we were having a conversation about where he thought America was headed.
Revolution?
You think so?
I do. I think it's headed there.
Flash forward to the violent scenes at the U.S. Capitol. I checked in with Bardo again to get his take, and he says we're inching even closer to revolution.
It just hasn't started yet.
And the violence at the Capitol? He believes the loose anti-fascist movement Antifa was there, causing trouble.
It was orchestrated. They will do anything to cause chaos and disrupt, and they had to figure out a way to turn the whole world against Trump supporters.
Let's be clear. There is no credible evidence to back that up. But like a lot of his information, Bardo heard that on Fox News.
And there are some reports that Antifa sympathizers may have been sprinkled throughout the crowd. We'll have more.
This is where we are. Our country is awash in disinformation. People get to choose their own reality. And in Bardo's reality, with the Democrats taking control, more violence is coming.
If it gets to that point where they come to try and take our weapons, if they want to stifle us any further than they already are with the free speech, it's going to happen.
Hundreds of miles north in Montana's conservative Bitterroot Valley, Marine Corps veteran Talon Lang says he's also worried about more violence. He tells me he was out shooting his rifle at a gun range recently.
And, the guy who was sitting next to me was talking about, this is all very important because we have the revolution that's coming and, everybody has to be prepared to, fight the government and the liberals and, socialism and all this kind of stuff.
Here's the thing, though. Lang is one of those liberals. And when he saw what happened at the U.S. Capitol, he says he wept for his country.
I mean, we had this whole segment of people who are they truly believe that they're patriots. And they're in that position and they're storming the halls of the Capitol because they believe falsehoods.
Those falsehoods have crept into small towns and rural communities across the West, helping fuel distrust in everything from public health measures to November's election. But Maddie Bishop says there's something else at play here, too. Bishop lives in Libby, Montana. He voted Libertarian in the last election, but says a lot of his friends are Trump supporters.
Even yesterday, as the images from the Capitol were being broadcast, they're justifying what's happening, that we've reached a breaking point, the system is broken, they feel betrayed, and to be honest, I think rural America has been betrayed, but that's happened over the course of the last 20 years.
He says many of his neighbors are angry and desperate because, in their minds, their traditional way of life has been taken away. Logging and mining contracts have dried up. Small businesses struggle to compete against big companies like Walmart and Amazon. America's wealth gap, after all, has doubled over the past 3 decades, and Trump tapped into some of that anger. Still, Bishop doesn't understand why some of his friends followed Trump down the rabbit hole and don't believe in facts anymore.
We're in big trouble because right now, what you call a fact, another person disputes and says, well, that's not true because I saw a YouTube video that my cousin posted and I trust him more than I trust this media guy. And it's detrimental to everything that we have no consensus of truth, no consensus of fact in this country right now.
A democracy without facts is like a truck without oil. The engine seizes. It can't run. That's what worries Julie Weitz. She lives in Sheridan, Wyoming. She was shocked by what happened at the Capitol.
I'm stunned.
But she says in Sheridan, there's also two realities.
I've noticed that when we have those conversations about Donald Trump, it turns into kind of a, I'll call it the whataboutism. It's kind of like a never-ending spiral that suddenly I find myself trying to explain or justify something that didn't really happen, that I can clearly see that person believes, but it isn't true. And so then I just feel like throwing my hands up in the air because they can't be reached.
For the Mountain West News Bureau, I'm Nate Hedgie.
Funding for the Mountain West News Bureau provided in part by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Republican Jason Villalba says his party is at a crossroads after recent events. KERA's Bill Ziebel talked to the former North Texas legislator.
Villalba calls the president a cancer on the Republican Party. Trump, he says, turned fiscal and social conservatives into extremists, many of whom believe and act on the president's lies.
For Trump to be the head of what used to be the Republican Party, is that this is the party of insurrection and sedition.
Villalba says after the Capitol assault, he's not sure if party leaders will try cutting out the Trump cancer or if more traditional Republicans like himself will be excised.
It's going to be a while. I think we're looking at a wilderness ahead of us for at least a couple of cycles while the Republican Party sort of regroups and recalculates and recalibrates what it is.
Villalba worries it'll look more like a cult with followers who will drink the Kool-Aid while they look like your neighbors.
Who now are comfortable essentially committing felony and breaking the law and moving forward with insurrection against our government. And they're comfortable with it because it's been normalized by their leader that's no longer a political leader, but almost a religious style leader.
Still, Villalba hopes the GOP reverts to its traditional identity. I'm Bill Ziebel in Dallas.
Air Force veteran Barbara Jordan led the Black New Mexico movement in Rio Rancho last summer, organizing for equality and justice for Black and brown people. Demonstrators there encountered angry pushback from hundreds of residents at some events, but she pushed on. KUNM's Khalil Aquilona reached out to Jordan to get her views on the insurrection at the U.S. Capitol. Many, including President-elect Joe Biden, condemned the law enforcement response, saying if it had been a Black Lives Matter event, things would have looked very different.
I do believe that it was a simultaneous attack. I think it was coordinated and well organized. For me, it was not surprising to see the tantrum that was displayed at the capitals across the United States. I feel like America showed us America. Mm-hmm. So for me, it's a call to action to other people who may be shocked or uncomfortable with what they saw to now finally jump on board and help us with this fight against inequality.
Now, you called it a tantrum. Why do you call it that?
I call it a tantrum because it's like a niche against white supremacy. And they are so hell-bent on not giving that up that they literally threw a tantrum.
Mm. So it's like, you took away my favorite thing. How can I exist without this? I'm going to fight for it.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Now, you're a military veteran. There are stories that point to other military vets and law enforcement officers being involved in the insurrection. As someone who has put their life on the line for the country and our constitutional rights, how does it feel to see people who took the same or similar oath as you did take part mm-hmm. in this insurrection?
So it's a slap in the face to me as a veteran who has served our country for 20 plus years. But I believe all the members involved, the veterans that was there, whether they were active duty or retired, they need to be investigated. They need to be separated if they're still serving. If they are retired, they need to have their benefits taken away from them because it lets me know, and it's a checkpoint too for our leadership in service, that racism exists in the military. That has often too been a thing that has been grazed over or ignored. It's a wake-up call for our leadership that they need to take a real hard look at what's going on. Anyone that was there at that protest needs to be investigated. If they took part in trying to breach the Capitol, they need to be separated. If veterans took part in breaching a Capitol, their benefits need to be taken away.
Many people, including President-elect Biden, have pointed out the disparity in the treatment between the BLM protests of last year and what happened on last Wednesday. Tell me about how you see that stark difference in treatment.
Let me tell you, for me, when I was watching it on TV, the names of so many of our Black brothers and sisters, our children, their faces came up for me. Their names came up for me. Tamir Rice, George Floyd. And it was like a dagger in my chest. And it was a confirmation to me that they were murdered without regard for their life, because they just don't give a damn. And if people think that we don't have this problem all across the United States and including New Mexico, they're wrong. They're point blank wrong. We have a serious issue here. It is time that people stop trying to turn a blind eye. It's time for people to stop trying to ignore it. And it's time for people to address it.
Now, let me ask you, some DAs across the country have said that people who took part in the insurrection will be prosecuted in their home states. How do you feel about that?
They need to be prosecuted federally. That's federal land. That's our house. They need to be on no-fly list. They need to be brought back to where the crime occurred, and they need to be prosecuted, because they would do no less for Black people.
As someone who has taken it into your own hands to stand up for a cause, what do you have to say to anyone who is upset with these events, who is listening right now? What do you have to say to them about what we must do as citizens?
We all have got to get involved. I consistently say this, and I'll say it again. We have to stay in the driver's seat of politics now. We do not get to be complacent. We do not get to sit on the sidelines. We need to be attending every virtual town hall meeting they're having about our civil rights. We need to be there. We need to be emailing our newly elected representatives and our senators. That's what we need to be doing with our energy right now.
Air Force veteran Barbara Jordan led the Black New Mexico movement in Rio Rancho. She spoke with KUNM's Khalil Eculona. Well, many have grave concerns for the future following last week's insurrection at the U.S. Capitol, including commentator Peter Goodman.
Joe Biden won an election that wasn't even real close. Courts rejected a slew of silly challenges to the voting process. So Donald Trump and others tried the coup. Congressional Republicans sought to veto the voters and keep Trump in office, and Trump upped the pressure by inciting a mob of domestic terrorists to invade the Capitol. Trump committed crimes by pressing other Republicans to violate their oaths of office, and probably by inciting mob violence, urging his followers to be strong and take back our country. Trump said he'd be with them, marching on the Capitol. His son encouraged the mob by threatening Congress folk that, "We're coming for you, and we're going to enjoy it." Naturally, neither Trump had the guts to be present, as promised, although the senior Trump very much liked watching the violence on television. The mob invaded. Journalists were beaten. Congress folk were threatened. Trump called out Mike Pence, saying he'd better stand up for Trump instead of following the law. So Trump's mob erected a gallows and chanted, "Hang Pence!" None of this should surprise anyone, except maybe how easy the feds made it for the terrorists to invade and trash the Capitol. Capitol Police and other law enforcement were out in force for Black Lives Matter protests. Why were they woefully outnumbered and strangely passive before white domestic terrorists? Donald Trump has been Donald Trump all along, a narcissistic and incompetent man who has always disregarded laws, contractual obligations, and ethical norms, and lying or bullying his way out of trouble. Senators Ted Cruz and Josh Hawley are pure ambition. They're smart enough lawyers to know that Trump's effort to overrule the election wouldn't succeed, but supporting it would make them look good to Trumpists in 2024. If the callow and craven Senator Hawley does try to run again for anything, we'll see a lot of that photo of him giving raised-fist encouragement to the mob about to trash the Capitol. We're lucky that Trump's not as organized or focused as Vlad Putin, that Dems hold a House majority, and that some combination of Trump fatigue and love of country caused enough Republicans to reject the coup attempt. Hearing McConnell and Pence say fine words, I hoped all this might revive a little bipartisanship. cabinet members are leaving Trump's ship. Republican senators say privately they abetted Trump's misconduct for too long. I'm torn between welcoming their awakening and recalling how long it's taken. It's safer to stab a king who's reeling from self-inflicted wounds. A majority of Republican representatives voted Trump's way, even after Trump's mob had trashed the Capitol and put them in fear for their lives. Repeatedly, Republicans lose the popular vote and get saved by the Electoral College. An indecisive election means the House chooses, with each state getting a vote. California and Wyoming count equally. Down the road, will Republicans actually veto an inconvenient presidential vote and install their own choice?
Goodman's opinions are his own and do not necessarily represent the views of KRWG or NMSU. In depth now, we speak with New Mexico U.S. Senator Martin Heinrich about the insurrection and how the country moves forward. We began our conversation this week with me asking him about his experience. He was in the Capitol at the time of the insurrection.
I had actually just left the floor of the Senate to go downstairs to make a phone call in the basement of the Capitol. Was in the hallway getting ready to go into an office there and make a phone call when the first Capitol police officer who had been injured, who had been maced in the face, was basically being carried, walked down the hall, sort of half carried, half on his own 2 feet, right at the very beginning of this. So I was aware of the situation a little earlier than most of my colleagues. At that point, I went upstairs and began to let my colleagues know that it appeared that the Capitol Police just simply did not have the numbers and that this situation was going to become very difficult to manage very fast.
And I'm sure this is something you never imagined that you would ever face in such a building that it should be so secure.
You know, so much of what I was acting on then, that at that point, was based on seeing this officer who had been attacked and hearing the radios go off on the belts of other Capitol Police in the hallway. And it was clear that they had lost the perimeter at that point. I went back out to the window because I wanted, you know, I think it was hard for some of my colleagues to process the urgency. I went back off the Senate floor and looked out the windows that faced to the west of the Capitol, that faced the mall and also the scaffolding structure where the inauguration is to take place. And at that point, it was pandemonium. I mean, it was a mob of completely unruly, uncontrolled, huge numbers of people climbing on the Capitol, climbing on the scaffolding that we used for the inauguration, beginning to rush the building itself. There were Confederate flags being waved and Trump flags being waved. And at that point, I realized that, you know, it was only a matter of time until the Capitol was going to be breached. And I basically had to decide between trying to shelter in an office there or go back to the floor with my colleagues and try to press the case that this is getting completely out of hand. So I went to the floor of the Senate and said, you know, it's only going to be a matter of time before the Capitol is breached. And within minutes, an announcement was made that people were inside the building. It wasn't that long after that until another announcement was made that apparently shots had been fired. We were not sure whether those were, you know, whether those were rubber bullets or real bullets in trying to push people back out of the building. It was from that point on, it was really sort of pandemonium, and all the doors to the Senate floor were closed to secure that location until the point at which the Capitol Police moved the members from the floor to a separate secure location. It was, you know, having had a chance to travel in places where tensions are high and people are armed, it was really, it was something to see.
Okay. You know, you've made it clear that President Trump should be impeached, should not be able to hold office again. I don't want to belabor that, but I do want to ask you about something that I have to say that for me personally, sitting at home was really a surreal moment. Even with all that has happened over the last 4 years, I think a lot of us were truly stunned when we saw the video of President Trump after the insurrection had began, and he was telling people to go home, but at the same time repeating that the election was fraudulent, and saying to the insurrectionist, quote, "We love you, you're very special." With the violence that we saw already by the time that he made these comments, to say the least, this was unprecedented, and some say extremely dangerous, reckless. What were your thoughts when you saw this?
We watched that from on television screens in a secure location that was largely made up of Republican and Democratic members of the Senate. And I can tell you there was just an enormous amount of, are you kidding me, just disappointment. And you know, there are definitely supporters of President Trump, including in the House and Senate, who I think will never break with him. But I saw many people who had defended Trump for quote, being Trump in the past, who got just how dangerous he is, how he has no remorse for any of these activities. And I think it's important to realize that even more dangerous than him inciting this mob was his willingness to create the big lie that led to this mob being in Washington, D.C. in the first place. And I think one of the most dangerous dynamics is how many people have been willing, without a shred of evidence, to just support the big lie that somehow this election was stolen. And when you have to prove actual facts in a court of law, again and again and again, this has been shown to be false. But conspiracy theories take root and they have consequences, and people die as a result. And I'm deeply worried at how many people, including people in very important positions of leadership, have been willing to enable that behavior by the president.
So, as you're aware, some have called for the resignations of Senators Ted Cruz, Senator Josh Hawley, New Mexico Representative Yvette Harrell, and others who voted against accepting the election results. And sometimes, in some cases, some of the folks repeating unproven allegations that you're mentioning here. What are your thoughts on this? Should they resign?
You know, I'm going to leave that to their individual constituents, but I would say that their actions have had meaningful contributions to this happening in the first place. I think it's really important to look at the people who enabled this behavior and enabled the president to whip a crowd into a violent frenzy that acted against the United States. And I think that Josh Hawley and Ted Cruz and a lot of other elected officials just thought they were gonna get a freebie on this one, that they got to burnish their Trump credentials. They knew they would be in the minority because clearly the math is what the math is. And the reality is that there are people who are dead today because of continually stoking the fires of this conspiracy theory. And of course the president is responsible for this. But there were many, many people along the way who enabled the president's behavior.
So you've probably also heard this, that some are saying that the Justice Department, beyond the actions that have taken place over the last few weeks, the Justice Department should look at charges against President Trump for his call to Georgia's Secretary of State seeking to overturn the election results there. What are your thoughts on that?
My thoughts are that we should return to the normal the normalcy of not having politicians tell the Justice Department what they should be doing. That should be an independent agency. It serves the country and the Constitution, not the president and not U.S. senators. Yeah. And I think they should make those decisions based on the law. And where there are crimes, they should prosecute them.
Okay, very clear. And that is certainly what President-elect Biden has said as well when he had introduced Merrick Garland to the public as his choice for attorney general. You know, regardless of what happens in court, I don't want to run out of time. So I want to move to asking you about what you think it will take to begin healing in this country. President-elect Biden is making this the subject of his first order of business as he becomes president.
Well, I think, one, it starts by simply having an adult back in the White House who's going to govern and not use that position to divide Americans. We're going to have our differences, and we always have, but there are leaders who choose to pit Americans against each other, and there are leaders who choose to try to bring the country together wherever we can. And I think it's hard to underestimate what a change in tone January 20th is going to represent, and just how refreshing it's going to be for many Americans to wake up in the morning and not feel like they have to check their Twitter feed to see what went awry the night before.
Yeah.
I also think it's really important to recognize that many of the people who have been caught up in some of these conspiracy theories have very real economic and other grievances that are important to address more systemically. And the fact that we've become a country that is so economically divided is part of why we're so culturally divided.
Yeah.
And being willing to work on those issues is important. And
yeah,
I think the next president understands that.
Senator, I know another issue in terms of moving us forward and healing in the country is dealing with social media. Many social media companies are, some would say, finally taking action, Facebook, Twitter, and others, when their platforms are used to spread violence, even suggest specific acts of violence. What do you make of this issue, and how we can move forward on this?
Well, I think we need to have a really robust discussion about what the proper role of these platforms are and when that crosses the line to a point where the platforms have responsibility for what is going on these social media various channels. I think we need to understand better some of the business models here as well too. You know, I've watched my own kids and how they interact with some of the video streaming services. And some of those algorithms seem to take people to more and more extreme places from very innocuous places. And, you know, clearly the social media companies have really had a very friendly, hands-off legislative or legal arena in which to work. And I don't know that has served the nation well. And I think we probably need to have a really robust discussion about what kind of responsibility, what crosses the line, and whose responsibility is it to shut off the circuit when these platforms are being abused, as they clearly are.
Certainly something I'm sure we'll talk about again in the future. Probably we could spend an entire show on that issue. Well, you know, along with the terrible events of the past few weeks, there was also a lot of celebration in Georgia with the historic Senate runoff election there, the Reverend Raphael Warnock becoming the state's first African-American senator, John Ossoff becoming the nation's youngest senator at 33, and Georgia's first Jewish senator. Your thoughts on this?
It was just a remarkable thing to watch. The level of turnout in Georgia was just historically off the charts. And to see people it's from both sides turn out in such large numbers and understand that these elections have enormous consequences for the country, it was a heartening moment. It was democracy in action. And I was up quite late, hitting refresh and watching the returns come in. And I think these are two incredibly dynamic candidates who complement each other in many ways. I am really looking forward to getting to know both of them and getting the opportunity to work with them, starting from a career from what was clearly a very historic moment in American and Georgian history.
Yeah, and you hit the nail on the head there. It was all about turnout. Enormous turnout, more young people, more minorities going to vote. And as you know, nationally, because of certain inequities with the Electoral College for the presidential elections and many other races due to gerrymandering, Democrats really have to have huge turnout in many cases in order to win. Do you think there are any lessons that Democrats can draw from Georgia, specific things that can be moved to other states?
Absolutely. I've been on a number of calls with Stacey Abrams over the course of the year, and what happened in Georgia did not happen in the last 2 weeks of the campaign. It was years of sustained investment at the community level, and the kind of organizing that is capable of overcoming the sort of ridiculous, inaccurate television commercials that have become the norm. And so I really think that the work that so many people in Georgia, and she's obviously well known because of her runs for office and well known on the national stage, but there are a myriad of organizations from various communities at work in Georgia at the community-based level. And I think that really laid the foundation that these two campaigns were then able to build upon.
Yeah, and I think we should all just say the obvious here, that getting more people to vote is a nonpartisan issue. It's simply something that is part of how democracy works. And that's something that I don't think we hear enough of, and we need to hear more of. In fact, in the last year, we heard just the opposite of some politicians, including President Trump, implying that we should restrict the number of people voting and do things to make it less likely that people would vote. I'm going to run out of time, and I don't want to do that. So I want, because I want to get to some of the things that now you can work with the new senators from Georgia on. And first among the issues, of course, is COVID-19. There's talk of additional relief, as well as putting money into this vaccination effort that is so critical to the country moving forward.
Yeah, I think that is clearly job one, is going to be recovering the country, both the country's health and our economy, from the pandemic that we've been struggling with for almost a year. clearly the vaccine rollout has been flawed. We had this amazing research and development effort on a timeline that we have never seen in world history, but the fundamentals of having a federal government making sure that the lines of distribution are actually in place and accounted for and things can happen quickly just isn't there. So having a change, a turn of the page with the new administration that is willing to take the responsibility to make sure that we rapidly ramp up the distribution of these vaccines, as well as simultaneously working on the economic aspects, which have been absolutely devastating for so many small businesses and so many individuals who are months behind on their rent or their mortgage. I think those are the things that we need to address right out of the gate with this new Congress.
Another thing that I know that you consider a major priority, as do many Democrats in the House and the Senate, is dealing with climate change. And I know that you have been specifically working on clean energy tax credits as one way to do that. Tell me briefly about that.
Well, we actually just passed a piece of climate legislation that, because it was wrapped up in all of these end of year politics, I don't think we'll ever get the recognition that it probably deserves. But what we passed at the end of last year was literally the biggest climate bill that's ever been passed in the United States of America. For one, we were able to successfully phase out hydrofluorocarbons. Not doing that could cause as much as 1.8 degrees of Fahrenheit of warming. These are incredibly powerful greenhouse gases. And we're now on a path to phase them out worldwide because America very much sets the bar for the rest of the world. In addition, we were able to extend clean energy tax incentives and invest robustly in things like energy storage that are going to allow us to completely decarbonize our grid.
Okay. Well, is there any specific item that was not included that you think is an urgent priority to move forward? And it'll be easier, perhaps, to do that now with President Biden and Democrats controlling the Senate as well.
Yeah, there are still many challenges ahead. We really need to be investing in the infrastructure of clean transportation. We should, you know, in my view, a robust infrastructure package early in the next Congress is going to be a climate bill as well as an infrastructure bill, if we can pull that together. And electric charging infrastructure is a critical component of that. Making our transmission systems work better in the country, that's a huge bottleneck for additional clean renewable generation. And then moving on to the whole next wave of decarbonization, really the electrification of large swaths of our economy, including transportation, but also space heating and home heating, things that very much today are done with fossil fuels. There are a lot of things to work on, and I'm excited about really trying to make, instead of having one big climate bill every, you know, 6 to 10 years or more, making each and every bill, every appropriations bill, every authorization bill, viewing it through what can we do to clean up our economy, to put people to work, and to get a hand on the climate change threat that exists. That's what excites me about the incoming administration than a new Congress.
I don't have to tell you that despite the climate crisis and the availability of more fuel-efficient vehicles, a lot of people are still buying gas guzzlers. Do you think any legislation might offer incentives to people to buy hybrids or plug-in hybrids as well as electric vehicles?
Yeah, no, absolutely. That was one of the things that we were not able to include in the previous package. With Republican control of the Senate. My hope is that we will continue to incentivize directly, not just, you can't efficiency your way to zero. So we really need to turn the corner to new technologies. that exist today that our labs have been working on for decades. Electrification of light transportation, including some very heavy duty trucks, is going to change the way we view transportation. Incentivizing that faster is a very important piece of how we decarbonize the entire economy. And when you see a truck that can go 0 to 60 in between 3 and 4 seconds and can tow, more than an F-350 diesel can today, you realize that the potential for this technology is in no way limiting yourself to smaller, weaker approaches to things. It's actually better technology that for those of us, you know, I used to own an F-350 diesel, lifted 4x4, you can do all of that better with electrons than you can by burning fossil fuels. And that's the future that I'm excited about.
Well, good luck on that. We look forward to hearing more as the legislation is put together, and maybe we can talk again when that happens.
Look forward to it.
New Mexico U.S. Senator Martin Heinrich. For that full interview, you can watch KRWG-TV's Newsmakers tomorrow morning at 11 o'clock. KRWG News This Week, I'm Fred Martino. Thanks for being with us. We move now to state politics, and of course, New Mexico's legislative session kicks off next week, and state lawmakers have many challenges as the pandemic continues to impact the state. This session, some lawmakers are working on bills they say can create a sustainable way to fund early childhood education. Anthony Moreno talked about that and other issues with James Jimenez, Executive Director for New Mexico Voices for Children.
Mr. Jimenez, thank you so much for joining us. I want to start things off with the news that your organization announced a new program focused on advocating for environmental policies that are aiming to make a positive impact in public health. What can you tell us about the New Mexico Environmental Public Health Network?
Yeah, thanks, Anthony. We're really excited about bringing together the work of New Mexico Voices for Children and the Environmental Public Health Network. The network was created by Denise Fort, who has been a long-time attorney, law professor, and been very active in environmental policy for many, many years. And she created it with the intent of making sure that people and policies very much reflected this notion that environmental policies oftentimes will have a direct impact on public health. So on the health of children and families. She approached us about joining the two organizations, and you know, we considered it for about 30 seconds and said, yes, that's a great idea. That's very consistent with the work that we do in terms of lifting up public health issues that impact New Mexico's children and families. And then we have a increasingly growing body of work around environmental and conservation and energy work. So it's the joining of two organizations that can really spotlight those issues of the environment and public health.
The New Mexico legislative session is going to kick off this month. It's going to be a 60-day legislative session. There's been a lot of news surrounding state lawmakers working to address early childhood education funding by passing a constitutional amendment that advocates say can permanently fund early childhood education by taking money from the land grant permanent fund. How do you see this legislation, House Joint Resolution 1, making an impact if it's passed by lawmakers and approved by voters?
Well, you know, the whole idea of seeking reliable funding for early childhood education programs actually came out of New Mexico Voices for Children even well before I worked there. So it's something that we have been supportive of for over a decade now. And really, it's the idea that we know that when we invest in high-quality early education programs, we really heighten the opportunity for children to, when they approach the schoolhouse doors at kindergarten, are really ready to learn in a way that, you know, they might not be if they don't have access to these high-quality early education programs. So it's something that, as I said, we've supported for a very long time. We think it's badly needed in a state like ours. And we think that by reducing the work of remediation too often teachers have to do in the early years, that we will really allow teachers in the K-12 system to spend time doing what they do best, and that's teaching, and spending less money on remediation in the early years of a child's life.
Now, the COVID-19 pandemic continues to impact our state. State lawmakers are going to be faced with how to provide some relief for families and small businesses in our state in the legislative session. I'd like to hear from you what you think lawmakers need to do to address this issue in this legislative session to bring some relief to families who are struggling in New Mexico.
Well, we know, of course, that the pandemic isn't over. We know that unemployment and reduced employment is still way, way too high, and that's not likely to change for many, many months to come. So among the things that we are advocating for is the notion that, just like the legislature did and like the federal government has done, we need to continue to put money in the hands of people in communities large and small all across this state, because we know that that money is needed for the very basics of life. It's needed for housing. It's needed for food. It's needed to pay utilities. You know, we are proposing and have been working with some organizations, including one in Las Cruces, CAFE. We've been working with them on a project that would make sure that all of those who are struggling are eligible for the kind of relief that we know New Mexicans need, irrespective of their immigration status.
James Jimenez is Executive Director for New Mexico Voices for Children. Mr. Jimenez, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you, Anthony.
This week, our StoryCorps Military Voices interview is with a deported veteran. We'll feature one portion today, another next week. Marine Corps veteran Michael Evans is interviewed by his friend, Army veteran Nick Paz.
I was born 3 hours outside of Juarez in a little pueblo called Casas Grandes. My name wasn't Michael Evans. It was Lorenzo Hugo Nunez Fernandez. When I was born, my father had cancer, terminal cancer, and he died when I was in May of the same year. So I was maybe, I don't know, 2-3 months. My mother was really poor, not like American poor, but like Mexican poor, where she didn't have any money, any food, anything. She just didn't have enough money to put shoes on my feet. So she left me with my grandparents on my father's side of the family. And she came to the United States illegally, looking for a job, looking for opportunity, looking for better work. And, you know, after bouncing around for a little bit, she found a job with a professor at UTEP doing in-house nanny stuff. So when I first came over, Spanish was actually my first language. But when I came over here, I eventually forgot it. Right. So anyway, so I came over. My mom had to like kidnap me from my grandparents. So we were living with the lady, her daughter and my mother. And the lady got a job offer at USC, University of South Carolina. And she offers me and my mother to go with her. So my mother was like, yeah, well, you know, we'll go with you. And she was up. So like when we go over to South Carolina, there's no Mexican people over there. My mother is not happy. She doesn't have any friends. There's a lot of racial tension, which I didn't understand back then. And my mother found out she was pregnant. So she went back to the Southwest. She came back to El Paso, I believe. She was really struggling. And the professor said, look, if you leave your son with me for an extended amount of time, I want to adopt him. I'll give him a better life. I'll offer him to make him my son. So my mother battled around the idea for a while, and in 1984, I was 6 years old, my mother gave the okay. I remember the professor, she tells me like this. She says, you're going to grow up here as an American kid. You're going to go to American schools. You can have any name you want. I want you to have an American name, because with other American kids, you're just going to have an easier time. So I remember watching a movie, and I was in love with this girl in this movie. The guy's name was Mike, and the girl, it was Michelle Pfeiffer. Oh man, she was so beautiful. And like in the end of the movie, he got the girl. So my mother was like, that's a good name, Michael Evans. In 84, I was adopted.
So you were adopted, and like, why are you not considered a citizen?
So I was adopted in 1984, and the laws were different. If I was adopted in 1986, I would have automatically been an American citizen. But the laws don't go retroactive. I don't remember Mexico, like, as a kid. You know what I mean? Obviously, now it's a different story, but as a kid, the only thing I remember Mexico is when I used to go visit my grandparents. I started getting into a lot of trouble.
So you're in high school, right?
Uh-huh.
You're around that time where you're about to graduate. What gravitated you towards joining the Marines?
When I was in Toledo, I was getting in trouble, right? I almost dropped out of high school. I said, look, I'm not going to go to school anymore. I'm about to drop out. And she was like, absolutely not. I'm talking, there was like, I was like really bad trouble, drugs, fights, like every possible mistake a teenage kid could make, I was making. So I went to go visit my biological mother that summer. And she was all like, okay, if you're not going to go to school back over there, like, it was a long fight. My mother did not want to take me in. I was a pretty bad kid. We worked something out with my adopted mother and my biological mother. And she said, okay, he could finish school over here. So in my junior year, I started finishing school here in El Paso in Canotillo, Texas. School here was completely different. I graduated on time. So I was actually shopping for recruiters. I already had the Marines in my head because, one, they were supposed to be physically the most challenging. Either way, I ended up joining the Marines when I graduated high school. I was the first one to sign up on the delayed entry program. There was five of us. After I did it, like, my friend did it, and then one of our friends did it, and then them two did it. And so there was five of us total, and like, we all went to a boot camp together on the buddy program.
So do you remember, did the recruiter ever bring up your citizenship at any point?
So one, he said, they all say it's an easier path to citizenship. Okay. It's not true. I mean,
but you didn't know this at the time.
Didn't know, and it wasn't really, you got to understand my mindset. Like, I never, ever thought that I would be deported. I always looked at myself as an American.
Next week, we'll feature another portion of the interview with Marine Corps veteran Michael Evans and his friend, Army veteran Nick Paz. Funding for this segment provided by the Heritage Assisted Living, taking COVID-19 precautions and offering specialized care for their residents, now accepting admission in their three sanitized homes. More information at 575-525-9215 or heritage-lc.com. You can hear all of our StoryCorps Military Voices segments in the StoryCorps section under radio at krwg.org. That's KRWG News this week. I'm Fred Martino. So great to be with you every week with the region's in-depth coverage. Thanks so much for all of your comments. You can keep them coming. The email address is feedback@nmsu.edu. And a reminder, if you joined us halfway through, we have that full interview with New Mexico U.S. Senator Martin Heinrich online at krwg.org, and tomorrow morning at 11 on KRWG-TV. If you ever miss KRWG News this week, no worries. We have you covered. You'll find it anytime in the local radio section at the region's homepage, krwg.org. Broadcasting from New Mexico State University, this is KRWG Las Cruces and KRXG Silver City. Enjoy the rest of your weekends.